We want to acknowledge that Carleton University and the other locations where we make this podcast are on traditional, unceded Algonquin territory.
We wanted something that had nature and some sort of human element, because that's what it's all about, like the human interpretation of nature.
Welcome, everybody. Today, I am thrilled to welcome Professor Tanya Davidson from the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Carleton University. Tanya has recently published a now awarded textbook, and we'll talk about that momentarily. Tanya has recently published an award-winning textbook called Season of Sociology, and we've invited Tanya in to talk with us about the textbook, what's in it, what makes it a seasonal sociology textbook, and all things textbook and introduction to sociology. So Tanya, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tanya, I've had a chance. I got the ebook version of Seasonal Sociology, mm-hmm. I've been looking through it, and I have a few questions I'd like to ask you about your textbook, if that's okay with you.
Please. Yes.
Okay.
Bring it on.
All right. So the first thing that struck me was the title, Seasonal Sociology. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about the idea behind creating a seasonal sociology textbook?
Okay. So one of the sort of genesis moments of this book was I gave, like, years ago, because book projects take a long time, I was teaching a course on the sociology of pop culture, and my class fell on Halloween, so I'm like, oh, fuck, I should do a theme lecture. You know how in, like, elementary and high school, your teachers wear, like, theme earrings? It was, like, that version of that. Right. So I gave a lecture on the sociology of zombies and vampires, and with pop culture, it's super easy to do stuff. Like seasonal stuff. And I was like, man, that was so fun. It would be fun to just do seasonal theme lectures all the time. And in sociology, since it's very broad, it's didn't seem so hard. But then I started, so it was sort of percolating in my mind. And one of the other sort of moments of inspiration for this book was, you know, when you're profs, we often get, book distributors coming to our offices, and I had one, and I was like, I always loved having conversations with them, and I was just like, it was the most baby of an idea, and this book distributor, Chris Guys, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, from U of T Press, was like, I was chatting him, totally unformed. He's like, wow, that sounds great. You should meet my acquisitions editor, Anne Brackenbury, who you know, Billy. So then I started thinking about it more, and I reached out to my my good friend and colleague, Ondine Park, who's the co-editor of this book. And that's when it really took a turn from being this sort of like theme sociology to actually thinking more robustly about this idea of doing a sociology of the seasons. The chapters really take up this idea of a seasonal sociology in quite different ways, both topically and in the, like, to the extent to which they engage with this idea of doing a seasonal sociology. As you, in the intro, we talk about how this idea of seasons is already something that we can use a sociological lens to make strange, right? To reconsider. So it's like, and I love those things in sociology, which you think are the most natural, the most, no, well, that you can't sociologize that. You can't sociologize like sleeping or, you know, something like seasons. That's just the weather. But actually, as unfolds in the book, everything about how we organize, how we make sense of time, the passage of time, the weather, what we do with it, how we talk about it, how we like use it as a object, as an opportunity for social solidarity, all of that stuff is very, very social. So that was the that's the big main gist.
And thank you, Tanya. And I've noticed in your textbook that it's nicely divided into fall, winter, spring, and summer, right? So that's another kind of subdivision, a seasonal subdivision that's contained within the book as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how we organized it. And we started with fall because it is a textbook. So we thought maybe, I mean, you can slice and dice it in so many different ways for teaching, or you could just start with chapter one if you wanted to. Fall.
And I noticed one of our colleagues, Professor Zoe Todd, is in the very first chapter about the Rideau Canal in fall. That was a very topical and timely first chapter to put in your textbook, Tanya.
Yeah, well, there are actually four Carleton colleagues in the book, so I can talk about that in a bit. Yeah. But the Zoe's chapter, I love like all of the chapters. I'm just working on my own intro, so I'm really doing more deep dive back into the book right now, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh, I love it. But Zoe's chapter, what it does is it introduces some ways of thinking sociologically and social theory from the perspective of Indigenous ways of thinking. And so it works in fall in a couple ways. It works because she anchors her chapter in this field trip to the Rideau Canal in fall that she took students on and noticed that all these fish had been killed in the process of draining the canal in preparation of the skateway, et cetera. But that is her opportunity to both introduce to students and really sort of critique these Western conceptions of ontology and epistemology. So it works in fall in that way because it's a fall story, but also because one of the things that I teach really right off the bat in intro is introduction to social theory, which then is, you know, you draw it out throughout the other things. So it's like an introduction to social theory from this Indigenous perspective in this fall moment. So that's what's going on there.
Well, it's one of the things... like overall about the textbook, the general impression I get as well as the specific impression I get is that it's so, like you said, anchored. It's so here compared to many other textbooks I've read. They tend to be deterritorialized, somewhat abstract, free-floating kind of textbooks. Mm-hmm. And it's really one of the kind of striking things about your textbook and the contributors is that it's so anchored in the here and now, in the present, and also in all of the land issues and the politics of that too, right?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that we were really going for when we put it together, is that I think there's a lot of value in traditional textbooks and doing this sort of like overview of the field and the literature. But this textbook works a little bit differently, where every chapter is its own contemporary working Canadian sociologists using their research that they're working on to introduce intro ideas. So it's all very sort of current and people's actual, you know, projects that they're putting forward there.
And is there something that you like most about it as a textbook, as an introduction to sociology textbook, say, compared to, you know, other textbooks that you may have come across in the past?
I think that it's kind of just like what I just said. I like that it's what I find about teaching intro is that there's this really sort of balance between doing something that's very introductory and assuming that students don't have or your readers or whatever have no knowledge of the field, but also doing something that is very interesting and provocative and juicy, you know? So it's like I wanted a, besides the sort of the seasonal bit and everything, I wanted an intro text that was really sort of just like compelling and intriguing and something that also wouldn't, my main thing that I always was pushing with the press was the size of the book. I really wanted it to not be humongous. I'm like, can we have an intro book that you can be reading while you're like on the bus and you're not screaming, right. I am 18 at university for the very first time. So I wanted it also, I mean, it's very textbooky. It has learning objectives and questions and all this stuff. But I also really wanted it to be just a book for a curious, broad public to pick up. That's why I've been like pushing it hard on my parents. I'm like, read this. You're also the target audience. Enjoy my book. And they have a little bit. So it's good.
Yeah, that kind of leads me to like my question that I've been sort of in the back of my mind. Well, I have many questions, but like this one about audience, mm-hmm. right? So like the seasons affects all of us, I think, in various ways, mm-hmm. not only intro students. So where do you see this textbook sort of fitting in the sort of sociological curriculum across universities or particularly at Carleton?
Actually, most of the contributors, one of the things that we are looking for when we are looking for people is people that taught intro sociology because we had an idea that they would have a sense of like the tone and what we are going for. So most of the people in it teach or have taught intro sociology. So that was like my main objective. But I think it also, it's a very, very Canadian book. Everybody in it either now or has, you know, studied or worked in Canada, and most of the mm-hmm. cases are very Canadian. So I think it would work in a Canadian studies curriculum, mm-hmm. cultural studies. There's a lot of sort of media stuff. There's some stuff wow. about the environment. It's not as, well, yeah, there, I mean, yeah. there are a lot of different ways, but also I think that there is a lot of theoretical diversity in the book. So if someone's teaching like a second year social theory book, there are a lot of studies where you could like pair it with, you know, nice. You could pair the book with intro to sociology, traditional text, or your social theory readings and be like, ah, and here we're doing introduction to Foucault. Now let's read this chapter by Alyssa Overend on the medicalization of seasonal affective disorder or something like that. So I think there are lots of ways it could be used. So like, what is your favorite season, Phil? I'll give you an example.
My favorite season is fall. Always about the fall. Yeah. And there's something about the late fall. So like seasons have mm-hmm. sort of like beginnings, middles, and ends, mm-hmm. right? And then like summer kind of toils with us, I feel. Like it feels like it's going to end and then it doesn't, right? But like fall is a nice progression. Like, you know, it's happening. Mm-hmm. It's getting cooler. The leaves are changing, right? Also, I don't like the heat.
Slowing down.
Everything just slows down. So the fall, definitely the fall.
I like fall too.
What about you? What, Tanya, what's your favorite season?
I like fall. I think maybe I wonder if a lot of faculty like fall, because it's like if you've always loved back to school season, you might stay in school forever and ever. But for fall, we have a chapter on pumpkin spice lattes and seasonal branding. It's a very consumer society sort of chapter. We have a chapter on Thanksgiving and the sort of gendered labor of the holidays. And this one I'm really putting into my gender lecture and the, an embodiment. And we also have a chapter on seasonal migrant workers and the state and stuff. That one's very relevant in COVID. But one of my favorite, I just want to tell you a fall story. We were looking for, because we wanted to also have theoretical range in the book, so it could be useful for teaching intro, and also a methodological range, so we're showing all sorts of different types of sociology in action. And we didn't have enough, at one point, we didn't have enough stuff that talked about crime or used stats. So I was working at Ryerson. I just went to like my next door office neighbor's office and said, Heather, you know, I'm working on this seasonal book. You're a criminologist and you use stats. And I have a space in fall. Can you, you know, you got anything for me? And she's like, no, like, I don't do, who does, nobody thinks they do seasonal sociology, right? But then I was just like, I'm like, isn't there a thing, you know, like back to school, I don't know. And she's like, actually, absolutely. There's a whole literature about school as this sort of context for crime and deviance and policing. Of course, reemerges every fall when you go back to school.
There you go.
So now what's like, it's an awesome chapter, back to school season, schools and the social organization of crime. So that's in fall as well.
So it takes a little bit of creativity, but the stuff is already there. And like when you were talking about the story about fall, the thing that kind of came to mind is how daylight savings always has this like huge social effect, right?
Fall, the huge Saskatchewan politics of daylight savings time.
There's politics involved.
All
right. Just another question and then I'll pass it back over to Billy. But you did mention COVID and this book has a long history in the making, probably starting before COVID was known and was a thing. You know, how does COVID factor into the book, or how does COVID, our experiences of COVID, change how we can experience reading some chapters?
Okay, I have an answer because I've been thinking about this. And it's one of the things that is so striking. I mean, when you, once you start doing something, you see it everywhere, right? So it's like during COVID, I'm just like, well, it's seasonal. Oh, it's like a seasonal thing. But one of the things that's so striking to me that COVID illuminates, which you see in the book, is how these seasonal traditions are so important for our sense of social solidarity. And it's so important. So in the book, I mean, there's a chapter that talks about these winter festivals in Edmonton. There's a chapter that talks about like sports games, the NHL, Boxing Day, Winter Classic. And there's all the, like, there's a chapter on Vaisakhi parades in Vancouver this spring, parades as this moment of spring solidarity. And so they're there, but what COVID has shown is that they are so important. We're willing to risk our lives and the lives of our community. So over Christmas, for example, there's something like 50% of Canadians just ignored the rules and were like, I don't care. I need my turkey dinner with the same, those 10 people or whatever. So that's one thing. I think that COVID has really highlighted how can you think, I'll give you another example. We think these things are like trivial or whatever. Halloween. Oh my God. That was such a big deal. It was like, people are so invested. They're like inventing shoots, candy shoots and all this. You're like, it's a candy holiday for children, but no, we can't let it go. So that's one thing.
No, that's great. And it, so you know, even if COVID isn't mentioned in the book, there's still a reading of COVID that's in there, right? Like that's what I find so fascinating with how your textbook is sort of put together, is that it's timely in that, like it's timeless in that way, right? Like seasons will always be with us. And then the sort of things that happen within the seasons, we're able to read against kind of our contemporary situation.
That's one of the fun things about the book is that, I mean, you can do, you can practice sociology literally all year long. It's something all that. Now it's like we had just had Blue Monday a few weeks ago. But also around now, like the end of January is when people start quitting their New Year's resolutions. And we have a chapter on that. So there's like going all the time.
So I can understand why I'm not picking up those dumbbells I got January 2nd now.
Yes. Read chapter 8 and you'll feel better about yourself.
Chapter 8 it is.
Can we talk a little bit about pictures and images in the textbook? And maybe to begin with, one of the things I noticed about your textbook, again, in comparison to the introduction to sociology textbook library I have in my office, is that there's a refreshing there's a refreshingly minimal amount of photographs in lieu of a refreshingly literary and prose-like emphasis. And I was just wondering, apart from the reduction in the overall price of the book, because it's a really good for value book, or it's a really good value or excellent value book for first years, was it a deliberate editorial decision on yourself or Ondine's behalf to try to minimize the photographs and the images?
Yes, I think just insofar as we wanted a more standard book and less of a big textbook, and we wanted a certain price point as well, to make it accessible to students, but also, and it's even much more accessible as an ebook. Everything is very accessible these days with the libraries. The images were mostly provided by the authors. There were very few that we actually had to pay for. There's one, I think, that has a picture of Wayne Gretzky in it in our chapter on winter sports, and that was the most expensive image in the whole book. I mean, the images we left to the author's discretion. We asked them if they wanted to contribute, and some did, and then we worked around permissions. Okay. There's we have archival images. One of the things you said that it was very timely, but we do also have one chapter by Matt Unger, who's at Concordia, which demonstrates archival sociological research methods, mm-hmm. and it's on the development of the colonial legal imaginary in Western Canada during this 19th century manhunt. It's a very compelling chapter.
Thanks, Tanya. Just as a slight aside, when you talked about methods, it was another thing that really struck me about how the book was written and the focus on the book, even from just kind of reading quickly through the first chapter and just kind of browsing through some of the other chapters, was there's a real emphasis on doing sociology and making sure that whatever the author is doing mm-hmm. in the book is known to the reader, and that they're doing a particular case study or they're doing a particular form of decolonizing form of methodology. Could you speak a little bit about the emphasis on methods, or the sort of importance of methods in teaching sociology or introduction to sociology?
Well, one of the things I always say to students when I'm teaching is that to do sociology, you need three things. You need an empirical object. You need a theoretical lens that you're using to analyze it or that you're developing, and you need method, a research method, so that you're doing something systematic and rigorous. So that is something that I just, how I understand sociology myself. So that was really important. But also the book was very thoroughly peer-reviewed. Some of the reviewers came back and said, we need more on explain how this is sociology, what was going on. So that, I mean, it was a process. But yeah, I'm glad that comes through, because that's definitely something we wanted to be clear.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm going to pop back to my question about the image now. And I want to ask you about the front cover image in particular, because I keep on saying this about your book, but it is true in all cases that your book is very different in a very refreshing and exciting way in relation to many other introduction to sociology textbooks that I've come across. And the image on the front is I think it's one of the most sociological images I've seen on a textbook, and one of the most interesting ones. It's an evocative image, I find. It's kind of rich in meanings. And I was wondering, would you like to speak to that image?
Sure.
Yeah.
I would say that cover images are maybe tied with title for the most difficult things. Because we had a lot of, we had a whole week of conversation. Oh, should it have a subtitle?
Right.
And we ultimately didn't go. If it had a subtitle, it would be maybe something about Canada, because it's so Canadian. And then, so, and that was a whole other thing. But this cover, So the publishers asked us if we had any ideas, and so we sort of brainstormed some ideas, and I crowdsourced with my friends that are art historians. So one of them suggested it, and this is to your listeners who aren't seeing the cover. It's an image of, you can't quite tell what it is, and you might still not even know what it is, but it's a whole bunch of circles on white. And then there's some little dots, and you're like, what is that? But what it is these are tracks made by a snowmobile. And the little dots are dogs. And
okay.
The image, and then it was photographed by a drone. And the image is the work of an artist named Laura Millard, and she's in Toronto. It's called Crossing.
Right.
And I was just, so we liked it without knowing so much. Like, we knew that it was like taken by drones, snowmobile tracks. So, okay. We liked it because we didn't, you know, you don't really know what you like until you see a bunch of stuff. You're like, nah, except not that. <It's> like, <Yeah. laughs> And with sociology, there's so many, a lot of sort of cliche visual metaphors for society. So we were like, and we didn't want to do like a four thing affairs with Lee. We wanted something that had nature and some sort of human element, because that's what it's all about, like the human interpretation of nature. And this one works because it's white, so it's not very overpowering, but it's also very like compelling. And I'll tell you, I just was looking this up, and she said about this, where is it, piece, that the circles, she's going around the circles, and she said that this crossing, Laura Millard, the artist, is a quote, a state of mind when you turn something over and over in your mind. Mm. And so it's kind of like, for me, it's like making, you know, the sociological thing of making the familiar strange. You're like, okay. Seeing something in a new way after revisiting it. So I think it works. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's such a rich and evocative image that it's just open to so many possibilities. I think it's fantastic. If I was a first year student looking at that, it would definitely get me to rethink a lot of things, to be honest.
Okay, good.
I have a question about the collaborative process. It's a co-edited book, co-edited by yourself, Tanya Davidson, and your colleague, Undine Park. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, or Undine Park, if I'm...
Yeah.
Undine Park. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the collaborative process. Was it a joint idea initially? Did somebody have the idea and ask the other person? How did it come about as a collaborative project?
Well, like I said, I had like the tiniest baby of an idea, and then it got much better and more robust as soon as I mentioned it to Undine. And we've worked together before. She's my, we were in grad school together at University of Alberta, and we published a co-edited book, oh my gosh, a decade ago, in 2011, right, with Rob Shields. So we've done this humongous, I don't know if I would jump into, I mean, I guess I did the first time. So, but yeah, collaborating, working, it's a lot.
Right.
But it is also very, it's a totally different type of work than working on a book by yourself.
Right.
In ways that are very frustrating, but also more overwhelmingly in ways that are exciting.
Absolutely.
It's like curating something. So you can have this, like, I love co-editing and doing collaborative projects, because you can have these sort of like blue sky thinking ideas.
Yeah.
And then just like pitch things to people and get their brilliant stuff from them and like work on it. And you're like, whoa, it's just amazing. It's that. So that is my positive. I might not have sounded like that like a year ago, but. Working with Undine, I mean, as I said, she's one of my very good friends, and we are a very good team. I think she's very, she's much more meticulous than I am. I'm much more, hyper and let's go, go, go. And she's more like, okay, but let's also
right.
make it good. That's a good combo because we both like get things done and they end up being quality. So,
right.
So yeah, I really like working with Undine. And then of course there are about over 20 other people in the book that we worked with, which was a big endeavor.
That must have been quite the project, I must say, Tanya. We're starting to come towards the end, and I've actually asked you most of the questions, if not all of the questions that I already had set out to ask. So before I ask Phil if he has any questions, or you seem to have a point you want to make, Tanya, actually, do you want to jump in?
I just wanted to say, since it's the department, it's the departmental podcast, that I want to highlight. We talked about Zoe, but we also have a chapter 12 by Rania Tafali, which was very fun to work with. So it's in spring, but she's a demographer in her department. And I asked her the same, like with Heather, I'm like, is anything seasonal with what you do? First blush, maybe no, but quickly, yes. And so her chapter introduces students to the broad field of demography, but talks also about the seasonal dimensions of birth, death, marriage, and divorce.
Yeah, I'm reading it here. Spring babies, summer weddings, fall divorces, and winter deaths, seasons and populations.
Yeah, so there's a seasonal angle to everything. And we also, there's another... Ben Wu, who's in the Department of Communications at Carleton, he contributed a chapter that is introducing students to media, sociology of media, and it's in summer, and it's on the phenomenon of the summer blockbuster.
Yeah, it's such a perfectly seasonal topic too, huh?
Yeah, also something very impacted by COVID.
Exactly.
Blockbusters.
All right, I have a final sort of question, and I've been hearing you speak about a lot of the examples and a lot of the case studies, the chapters from contributors to the book, and maybe this is just my own excitement for the theme of seasons, but give us a little bit of your thinking. Is this volume one of many editions to come? Where we can see contributors coming together around this theme of seasons. What are your thoughts today on that?
Well, that is such a nice and generous like final question, because it allows me to say we just found out yesterday that the book won the category for single and multi-volume textbooks in the social sciences, which is wordy, but I feel like that's a big, big category from the American Association of Publishers. So with that stamp, maybe there will be another volume. And there is a ton of, I mean, there are a lot of things that are seasonal, things that are not in this book, like Elf on a Shelf, I really want to talk about. Halloween. There's not that much about Halloween. I don't really at all. So there's lots of room for more seasonal sociology. Billy, I just saw your colleague Mervin is doing a lot of sociology on outdoor rinks.
Oh,
so that's something for the future.
Mervin in the University of Guelph.
Yeah.
I forgot to congratulate you on your award specifically, Tanya. Yes. So thank you, Phil, for reintroducing that. And you're right, it's a huge category. So double congratulations on that, because it is such an enormous category to win, right? So congratulations again.
Thank you. And I thought what got me really excited is that the book is so, so, so Canadian. So I'm like, the American publishers must have had to get over that big hurdle of having to care about Canada to to read the book. So that's
well, and especially like with a whole bunch of snow on the cover, yeah, right? Like yeah. if you're in Arizona or something, you're like, what is this, relate, right?
But yeah, it does.
But we use our imaginations, which is part of the book. Tanya, thank you so much.
Thank you
for chatting really with us about the book. It was a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much, Tanya. And we hope to hear from you again or read from you again sometime soon, hopefully.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for joining us, Tanya. I really appreciate it.